paper is based on my PhD research, which I have recently completed at the University of St. Andrews. So I hope that you enjoy the presentation. Now, at the moment, foreign academics constitute a significant part of UK's higher education. So the latest available data at the moment is that from the academic year 2017-2018, and that year, migrant academics constituted 30% of UK's academic workforce. However, as you can see from the table on your right, the proportion of foreign academics has been increasing for a number of years, a number of decades. So this table shows the increase in the last 9 years. However, the number has been growing over the last 40 years, which is when the first data on the numbers of foreign academics in the UK becomes available. So here, in 2009-2010, migrant academics constituted only 23% of British academia, while now it has already turned into 30%. So their number has been growing consistently, in particular the number of European Union academics. Research on migrant academics, especially within management, which is the discipline in which I'm based, dedicates a lot of focus to the analysis of international academic careers. So why do academics move to a different country, and how exactly is international mobility helping or hindering their career development and progression? Existing research highlights a number of challenges and inequalities that academics face when they're moving abroad. So for example, student expectations and academic standards differ across borders, and migrant academics have to navigate that. Some of their teaching or administration experience is not very easily translatable to experience in a different country. And so if academics were focused on teaching or administration in their previous role, then some of that experience might not be adequately chronicled. Research also shows that some of their publications might not necessarily be recognized if they're moving abroad, because universities tend to take the nominal equivalence of what is a journal worth, how high is the journal ranked in the UK, without necessarily taking into account that this might be considered a leading journal somewhere else. Also, when academics move to a different country, some countries they might only be entitled to have a temporary contract and their visa would be temporary. So we have to navigate this temporary employment and temporary work permit status. And naturally, relocation to a different country comes at a personal cost and also at a financial cost. So they might be leaving their families behind, they might be leaving their professional network behind, their friendship network behind, and of course, moving to a foreign country costs money. So there are a number of challenges that existing research outlines. Now, if we look at research on migrant academics coming to the UK, however, they emerge as quite a privileged, if I might say that, group. The research is highlighting that there are a number of entry opportunities, in fact, until recently, a growing number of entry opportunities for foreign academics to access UK's higher education. So for example, academia has a well-developed international mobility infrastructure with academic mobility schemes such as the German Academic Exchange, LAD, or Marie Curie, or also European Research Area that makes it easier for academics to move within the European Union. And until recently meaning until the Brexit referendum happened, UK was the country that has been benefiting the most from Marie Curie academic exchange. But now it has changed and Germany has been moved. English is also the lingua franca of academia, which means that it is easier for foreign academics to come to the UK and to communicate with their colleagues. And staff internationalization is also included in some of the criteria that are used for university assessment, such as, for example, the ECWIS or the US World University rankings. They do take staff internationalization into account, which means that for some of the more instrumental universities, they might be incentivized to hire a foreign academic above a local academic because this is something that they are being assessed on. Research is also showing that or found that migrant academics in the UK are in fact in some ways advantaged compared to their British colleagues. So for example, they progress with their careers faster. So a study by Rudini, Fernando and Colin found that Indian scientists in UK's research intensive universities, they use their international networks from India for their own career progression, or research by PSN, for example, has found that foreign women academics advance with their careers faster than their British peers because being a migrant distracts the profession from their gender status and they can avoid the stereotypically female roles and stereotypically female responsibilities in academia. Also, the recent statistical data shows that male and female Caucasian, so white migrant academics, also earn more than male and female British academics. However, ethnicity gap still remains. So the research shows that it seems great to be a migrant academic in the UK. And this is exactly the thing that I decided to look into for my PhD. Because academia has been criticized repeatedly about being, disadvantaging the groups that are different from the white middle class and white middle class male occupational ideal. Migrant academics are also different from white middle class male occupational ideal, and yet they seem to be advantaged. While the research on women academics, for example, found that women academics' careers progress slower. They also face challenges accessing international research networks, meaning that they face biases trying to access those networks. Working class women also struggle to reach the top of academic career ladder, or black and ethnic minority academics, their courses were found to receive lower MSS scores. So again, there is almost some sort of a penalty if you are different from white middle class male occupational ideal, and yet that doesn't seem to apply to migrant academics. So I was curious to find out why is that the case. And so I decided to look at how has the academic profession reacted to the increased presence of foreign incomers. Why is it that migrant academics, who are also different from the white middle class male occupational ideal, seem to be advantaged in UK's higher education? So how has the profession, what has the profession them, how has it reacted to them? In this paper, we use the social closure theory to address this research question. So social closure theory is concerned with the basis of social structuring and with the dynamics of inclusion or exclusion among social groups. Social groups, such as professions, which I'll talk about in a minute, establish formal or informal rules of inclusion into a particular group that will be allowed to monopolize opportunities and exclusion of competitors. So migrant academics would be competitors. The rules of inclusion or exclusion can be based on individualist or collectivist criteria. So anything that has to do with merit, say for example having the right qualifications, credentials, would be considered an individualist criteria, while collectivist criteria are ascribed. So they can be ethnicity, nationality, religion, or gender, for example. So these are the collectivist criteria on how someone might or might not be included or excluded from a social group. So establishing closure among groups allows that particular group to safeguard limited rewards. Those rewards can be economic, say, financial, money, salaries, or they can be also social and cultural. However, establishing social closure within a group also means that you trust the people that belong to your group and you distrust the people who do not belong to that group. Say your group coalesces around, like in Harry Potter, then you know you trust the people who also like Harry Potter and you dislike the people who, or you do not trust the people who do not like Harry Potter. Now, professions like academia, law, engineering, or architecture are a particular type of social group that has managed to successfully monopolize a particular body of knowledge and skill. And entry into a profession, the main rule of entry is based on credentials. So, for example, you can't practice as a doctor unless you have appropriate qualifications. Or now, say you can't practice as an engineer if you do not have appropriate qualifications, and also if you do not have a license, which you get after getting some practical experience as well. Now, professions also obtained self-governance, which means that these groups are themselves responsible for the production of producers and the production by producers. So let's take academia as an example. If you apply for a PhD program, then other academics will be responsible on this into that PhD program. And your PhD will be overseen by a supervisor who is also an academic. So this is how the profession controls the production of producers, the production of future academics. Academia also controls the production by producers. Say, for example, when you send a paper out for peer review, then somebody else is going to review your paper and is going to give comments on the paper. So this is one of the many ways in which the profession itself controls production by producers. So this is known as occupational professionalism. Now, professions are also very resilient. Over the years, academia and other professions have experienced a number of threats to this self-governance of how they work. For example, the access to higher education has widened, which means that there are more people who are qualified to enter a particular profession. Or new public management initiatives have been introduced in the UK, which means that government increasingly controls what the professions are doing and also audits what those professions are doing. In the case in academia, the REF has been introduced, or the research assessment exercise, as it used to be known. Now there is also the teaching excellence framework. The student-staff ratio has increased. Performance management was tied to publications and grant income. Or also, yes, government quality assurance system is another way in which external mechanisms of control have emerged, in addition to profession itself controlling how work is being done. So profession has adapted, and it has established not only the labor market control mechanisms, but also the organizational control mechanisms. So it has established the so-called occupational double closure, where it controls what is going on in the labor market by, for example, licensing practitioners, but it also controls what is happening within the organization. So say, again, in the case of academia, line managers or senior management are, well, that can be challenged, but they're more likely to be other academics rather than somebody else. Now, when profession is faced with the threats to its self-governance, then research has found that the nature of inclusion in that profession also changes. So studies on the legal profession have shown, for example, that when there were more graduates who had a law degree, then entry criteria into becoming a lawyer or into working in a private law firm have stayed the same. So you still need to have law qualification. However, the nature of inclusion, the nature of inclusion has changed in the sense that it became harder to progress through the ranks. So it became harder to get to the top. So entry qualifications stay the same, career progression requirements have changed. Other studies also found that when women started, when women were granted access into the legal profession, then profession has continued to maintain its patriarchal core by segmenting women. So women are more likely to be found in certain areas of law, such as, for example, family law or employment law, rather than in corporate law firms. So profession has essentially adapted the way, adapted its internal closure mechanisms to still make sure that the old system, the old criteria of inclusion are sustained, which again makes the case of migrant academics interesting, because in the UK interesting because they keep joining UK as academia in increasing numbers, and they also progress within academia also in increasing numbers. So with this theoretical background and empirical background, I spoke with 62 migrant academics, foreign-born academics working in European British universities. And I spoke with them about their experiences of navigating three main areas where profession might exercise exclusion, international exclusion, which is the labor market entry, so accessing the profession, work, control of work, and also social relationships at work, so group cohesion, intra-group cohesion. My participants, 29 of my participants were female, 33 were male, and I recruited them through Snowball Sampling. And all of my interviews were recorded and transcribed with myself and by myself, and you can imagine that took quite a bit of time. And I also gave my participants an opportunity to review the transcripts because I wanted to make sure that they are happy with what they said and that they are happy with the degree of anonymity that interview transcripts have. So
can I ask, because I was going to ask you, you know, at the end anyway, when you say foreign-born academics, or are we talking about people who are academics here and not British nationals? Is it your definition? I mean, I'm talking about the foreign-born.
Yeah, so
they're adult immigrants to an academic job, right?
So I chose a broad definition of who is a migrant academic. So I chose migrant academic as a foreign-born academic who can also now be a British national. So as long as a participant was born in a foreign country, they might have naturalized in the future, by the point of the interview, but I still counted them as migrant academics because at some point of their broad academic career, meaning at some point of their studies or work, they have moved into the UK.
So after they completed further education, they didn't socialize in the system.
So some of this is one of the points of comparison that emerged from the data. So some of them have completed a British PhD, so they have a British academic nationality, and some others have completed their doctoral degrees abroad. Some of them also had some work experience abroad as well. So this is indeed one of the points that I will be making later on, that the country of where a doctoral degree has been completed kind of does affect the way in which profession has reacted to you as a migrant academic, essentially. So yes, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So indeed, because I chose a broad sample, then this actually, I mean, it came of course with a with various challenges as any sampling decision does. But it also allowed me to kind of gain, I guess, a deeper insight into the internationalization of UK's academia. When we see statistical data from Higher Education Statistics Agency, that data is based on citizenship alone. So it is easy to see that, to say that the number of migrant academics or foreign academics is increasing. Well, actually, what we are seeing from the data is that there are subtle ways in which profession operationalizes social inclusion. One of those ways is, for example, through the requirement of UK-specific experience, but I will get to that in a minute. So publications was the most commonly mentioned thing why academics believe that they were successful in getting a job in British academia. And some quite openly spoke about being used for ref coaching, which means that, for example, they had a substantial publication record and they were hired shortly before the research excellence framework cut off. So they believed that university needed them and their publications to essentially boost the university's position in the ranking tables. Some of them were moving from the United States of America, for example, even just after their PhD, but the longer duration of the doctoral program there has allowed them to gain more experience and on some occasions also have more publication, which again helped them in the countries enter UK's academia. However, something as easy to count as publications essentially means that those migrant academics needed to demonstrate being a competent Anglophone academic. Most journals are published in English, written in English. A lot of the top-ranked journals are dominated by UK or US academics. So for example, in the out of the 33 journals on the Chartered Association of Business Schools list, 31 are US-based. So essentially, the closure regime, the publications-based closure regime, is Englishized or even Americanized, which disadvantages, in several ways, the non-native English speakers who might find it harder to write. They might take it longer to produce those publications. But also academics who were moving to the UK from higher education, from say a German or a Spanish higher education system, and who may have published in journals that are considered leading in those countries, but are not necessarily considered leading in the United Kingdom.
Because so, citation indices only recognize it in English language.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Citation indices only recognize English language. They can't quote with foreign.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, Surab does have a provision, I believe, for submissions in a foreign language, and there has to be a translation, isn't there? But according to research, at least, it doesn't, it's not that easy, and it doesn't necessarily work that way. So academics, those who came to the UK from especially Germany, but also France, for instance, they spoke about having pursued a very purposeful strategy of internationalization in order to access UK's academia. So Alfred's citation here says that he purposefully chose to publish in English in order to have more options of being employed in a foreign country, ideally UK. However, there were a number of other internationalization strategies that have been adopted by scholars. So those who moved to the UK 19 years ago, they still had the option of writing work in, say, French and then translating their work. While others, for example, purposefully sought publishing contracts with American or British publishing houses because they saw it as a more reputable publishing house that would open more doors for them. So again, pursuing a strategy of internationalization pretty much became the way in which, or the only way in which they thought they can enter UK's academia. And another interesting finding that emerged among history and modern languages disciplines was that migrant academics had to demonstrate being sufficiently British. In other words, they were required to have UK experience, which means having lived in the UK, having studied in the UK at some point of their life. The UK experience requirement was primarily sought as a proxy, as an indicator that academics are familiar with, especially the teaching expectations and the expected care for students in the United Kingdom. So here, Eleni's saying that what they're looking for when they're hiring French speakers is the French speakers who know the UK system. And all the French speakers in the department where she worked at the time of the interview, they actually had a PhD from the UK. So it's not just about being able to speak English and speak French in this case, but it's also about having the flexibility and knowing the teaching ethos of the place. Now, not all of the interviewed academics in history and modern languages had UK experience when they entered UK's academia themselves, which suggests that this requirement, this new exclusionary requirement, emerged not more than 16 years ago. And it seems to have emerged largely as an outcome of increased pressures to publish, whereby one of the participants, for example, said that he wants to focus on publishing books. He wants to prioritize the areas that he wants to prioritize, and so he does not want to take a risk of hiring somebody who comes across as being a time-consuming liability, who might need a little bit more time to who might need time to receive like an explanation of how things work in the UK. So he doesn't want to take the risk. However, although in our findings, the UK experience requirements was only merged in history and modern languages disciplines, it might indeed be applicable more widely, as migrant academics are statistically more likely to be recruited for research jobs than for jobs that involve UK. The way to circumvent this closure that required a demonstration of being sufficiently British and sufficiently Anglophone, and that was entering British academia through an international academic exchange program. So Patrick said quite openly that the only reason why he managed to get a job in British academia without having UK experience in his case was because he was not chosen by his British employer. So he wasn't chosen by the British academic profession, but he was chosen by the German academic exchange service to represent Germany. After having spent 3 years in the UK, he then felt confident that he knows how the system works, that he has the currencies that are required for the UK's labour market, and he applied for permanent jobs in the UK, and so he got a permanent job in the UK. Now, profession retained access, control over access to permanent jobs, and that meant that some of the academics who entered UK's academia through an international exchange programme but have not internationalised their research outputs sufficiently experienced underemployment. So Anya here is essentially saying that she has been publishing in leading German journals, but those journals are not considered to be leading here. So what she did in Germany, the experience that she has applied in Germany, doesn't count here. And she was offered a permanent lectureship in the UK when she completed 1 year of her Marie Curie academic exchange program. So yes, she has accepted that lectureship, but she felt that she should be, that she has more experience than that lectureship required. Now, in terms of work, it would seem that migrant academics are well integrated by the UK's academic profession. They cherish the autonomy over the research approaches that they were allowed to have, and also they felt that in terms of teaching, they felt that they can offer students more, especially when students are international. They felt that they're able to empathize with them more and to advise them a little bit more, having some common experience to share. However, non-native English speakers, above all, were feeling they seem to be in a bit of a subordinate position, whereby they believe that it takes them longer to conduct research in a foreign language. For example, some of them were reading the works of sociological thinkers, not only in English, but also in their language, native language, to make sure that they capture the subtleties of thought, while others had to develop a new authorial voice or a new authorial identity, and so their writing in English was slower as a result. Others were careful that their accent, their foreign accent, may become a means to judge their competence in teaching. And this one has already been observed in United States academia, that foreign academics are being judged more harshly because of the accent that they have. And so this word here, Reichstätte, makes exactly this point. She said that she was worried, especially when she started teaching, that she has an accent and what will the students say, and that she will be accused by students and subsequently by her managers, that she just doesn't get it. So to mitigate this, she was trying to overcompensate. She was trying to put in more work, put in more time, extra hours, to make sure that nobody can accuse her of doing something wrong, just because English is not her native language. So to compensate for the difference, Steffi and other migrant academics were trying to work harder, so put more hours, or also produce more, produce more papers to say that, you know, we're just like you, we're compensating for our perceived deficiency. So that's like Artem is here saying that as a foreign academic, you have to prove more things that a local, a British academic might not necessarily have to prove. So ironically, this makes migrant academics who resemble the stereotypical good migrant worker observed usually in the low-skilled jobs that the good migrant workers are perceived by managers to have a qualitatively different attitude to work and to have a strong work. Now, whether this is at least according to the perception of migrant academics themselves. So ironically, this might help to sustain the professional project of the leading elites, because putting it more work automatically raises the expectations for, or may raise the expectations for the, for everybody else's performance. So essentially, an approach that stems from subordination might actually help the leading elites of the profession. Now, in terms of social relationships, an interesting paradox emerged, where national background was salient in work situations and work contexts when there was a clear national majority, while in international work settings, where there wasn't a clear national majority, then national migrant academics' different national background was not that important. So in international workplaces, social closure was grounded in sharing the same language, English, and in being foreigners. So in other words, everybody is a foreigner, everybody shared a commonality in difference. So there was a common identity among academics themselves. So Raquel here is essentially saying, you know, well, nobody is actually a local. We're all foreigners, we're all different. And the academic profession, or her experience of the British academic profession, is actually, it seems to be quite detached from what she's seeing in the UK's culture. She feels integrated in the profession, but she feels marginalized in the British society. So a profession is almost a completely different world. Now, in the work environments where there was a clear British national majority, national majority reinforced subtle inequalities. Well, yeah, it used subtle inequalities to maintain the powerful position of the majority. Now, subtle inequalities manifested, for example, as stereotypes or jokes linked to migrant academics' different national origin. So, say, German academics were mocked for their punctuality or for their attention to detail, for them being good at administration. Italians were being mocked for their lateness or for talking and using a lot of gestures. American academics were accused or mocked for being stereotypically positivists, or they were also being approached for comments about United States politics as if they were representing the country. Now, academics, migrant academics themselves did not necessarily see this as a negative experience, but rather as a good diversity point. However, an argument can be made that this nonetheless reinforces subtle inequalities because it ties migrant academics to one particular aspect of their identity, which is being a migrant, rather than any other interest, for example, that you might have. Because of these subtle inequalities and of this distance that continued being maintained, migrant academics experienced social exclusion, loneliness and social exclusion, where they reported being integrated in terms of job duties, but marginalized socially, so they could not fully engage with the British academic profession. So Paul here is saying exactly that. He's saying that when the teaching semester is on, is not on, then in a small place like the university where he works, he experiences his workplace as a wasteland, and he can spend several weeks with not a single person to speak to. Another outcome for migrant academics in working in predominantly British environment was that they were trying to fit in by imitating what they saw as being the typical behaviors of a typical British academic. Now, these behaviors ranged from professional to completely trivial, and the attitudes, the behaviors to be imitated were, academics were self-selecting what to imitate. So, just to give you a couple of examples, Pongalini, being a typical British academic, meant learning how to send passive-aggressive emails at work, because this is what a typical British academic does. For Miguel, a typical British academic is somebody who is polite all the time. So again, the polar opposite from Galina's experience. For Sabrina, a typical British academic knows how to hold knife and fork in the typical British way. So she was training herself how to hold knife and fork in a British way. And this is when I learned that there is a British way of holding knife and fork. Other academics spoke, for example, of learning or figuring out which is the right side of the pavement to walk on, or going to a workshop organized by the employer, the cultural training workshop organized by the employer, and learning that it is not common to shake hands in the case of academia. So again, some of these can be completely trivial or even questionable. But the most common attribute, behavior of a stereotypical British academic that was imitated was the British accent. And it wasn't just any variety of the British accent, but it was the Queen's English variety of British accent, which also highlights the class-based nature of the case of academia. Imitating Queen's English accent emerged more often when migrant academics were in the positions of leadership and authority. So teaching is one of the examples, while, say, chairing a meeting among colleagues could be another example of when they were trying to imitate the Queen's English accent. Trying to imitate accent wasn't only common among the non-native English speakers. The quote here indeed shows Emma, who is a senior lecturer from New Zealand, who was also trying to eliminate the New Zealander flip at the end of her sentences, because teaching in the UK, living in the UK, interacting with her colleagues, she realized that often this flick annoys people, and so she just made sure that this flick disappeared from what she was doing. So imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, but by imitating the stereotypical behaviors of the typical British academic, migrant academics also reinforced the national majority's power to define how to be, what is the appropriate way of being. And in doing that, they also supported the existing patterns of social segregation between national majority and national minority. So just a couple of concluding thoughts. Profession incorporates migrant academics selectively. So on the whole, migrant academics' experiences were characterized by their need to fit in constantly at labor market access at work and also in social relationships at work. But some were closer to fitting in than others. So for example, being a native English speaker helped on a number of occasions having UK experience. For example, they having completed a British PhD was also making labor market access easier, for example. And so on the whole, three distinct social career strategies can be identified that the profession exercises or rationalizes towards foreign work academics. Migrant academics are integrated in the sense that they're treated as trusted members of a community of shared values. For example, when they have the publications, when they show that they're competent Anglophone scholars, or for example, when they work in international environments, and so their national background doesn't matter anymore. Migrant academics are also subordinated, for example, when they try to imitate the behaviors of a stereotypical British academic, or when it takes them longer to, for example, write a paper or to prepare for teaching, while performance requirements are the same for everybody. At the same time, migrant academics may also be excluded in the sense of not being able to fully engage with the professional community. And being excluded does not necessarily mean not being able to get a job because of, let's say, a lack of UK experience, but it also means, for example, being socially isolated or being excluded from socialization opportunities, as was the case of academics who work in predominantly British environments, where there was a distance between the British academics and the foreign academics, who had different experiences and different expectations. So moving away from analyzing careers shows that academia has developed distinct ways, distinct patterns of inclusion of foreign-born academics, and that migrant academics are not a homogenous group, but intra-categorical differences matter in understanding how profession has received them. So thank you very much for listening to me, and I would love to hear your questions and engage in further discussion.
Thank you very much.